From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Georgia rarely has to worry about hurricanes.
Georgia had many major storms in the 19th century, including, I think, four in the 1890s alone. So we've really gotten lucky that we have avoided this bullet for so long.
That's Stan Deaton, senior historian at the Georgia Historical Society. We'll talk more about Georgia's hurricane history later this hour. First, though, extreme weather drove millions of people to evacuate their homes over the weekend. We talked to a couple of them at the fairgrounds in Perry, Georgia.
My name is Elizabeth, and I'm from Waltherville, Georgia. So if I didn't have my horses, I'd probably still be at home. So I evacuated because I didn't want to put the stress on them, because I didn't want them in the middle of the storm.
My name's Ann Ecker, and I'm from Richmond Hill, Georgia. My husband is still in Richmond Hill. Even though it was mandatory, he decided to stay. So he's at home now, but he cannot leave, because if he leaves, they won't let him back in.
GPB has updates on the storm all day. Our news team is spread throughout the state, bringing you coverage. Stay tuned to GPB and tell us what you're seeing outside, how you prepare for extreme weather. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post on Facebook and we might feature your comments on the show. Hurricane Irma is now a tropical storm, but Irma is still a threat. I'm joined on the line by a National Weather Service meteorologist, Dave Nadler. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm safe. I hope everyone else is also. What does this, it was a Category 1 before 8 a.m., now it's a tropical storm. What does that mean?
Yeah, basically it just means that, you know, the Irma is continuing to weaken. It was a very low-end Category 1 hurricane earlier this morning, but at 8 a.m. with the update, it's been downgraded to a tropical storm with maximum sustained winds of 70 miles per hour.
Now, and it has started to kind of curve more west as well. Is it a possibility it will miss Metro Atlanta?
No. I think, I think that, you know, the center of the storm may not, you know, move directly over Atlanta. It's kind of moving more to the northwest now. I think that track or that motion is going to continue through the day, just because the center of the storm doesn't move like right across a specific area doesn't mean the impacts won't be felt for a very wide area around the state.
So when I was buying groceries, the cashier said, it's just a tropical storm. There's nothing to worry about now. Why is that wrong?
Well, because I think tropical storm force winds can reach up to 70 miles per hour. And I think we all know, like with severe thunderstorms, if we start getting winds like above 60 miles per hour, we know that, you know, there can be down like large trees that get knocked down or snapped. Certainly power lines can get down. We can see minor structural damage. So with these even tropical storm force winds between 40 and like 70 miles per hour, they're still going to result in downed trees and power lines and minor structural damage. And that can be a threat to life and property.
And I assume that's especially true in a place like Atlanta where there are so many trees.
Absolutely. And another thing to consider is that with all this rain that's coming in as well, in addition to the wind, when the ground's become a little bit more, saturated from the rainfall, some trees could be more easily like uprooted or snapped.
Okay, so what kind of things can we expect over the next, 24 hours? If you're in Metro Atlanta, what are we going to see from Irma?
Well, through the day today, expect just an increase in rain and wind. The rain's going to continue all day pretty much, but the rain intensity may start to increase later this morning and definitely through the afternoon hours. In addition to the heavy rainfall, the winds are going to pick up. Right now we're seeing winds around Metro Atlanta gusting maybe in the between 25 and 35 miles per hour at times. That'll start to increase as Irma gets a little bit closer to our area. So expect winds to, you know, increase into like the 40s, and we can certainly see some gust into the 50s and maybe even around 60 miles per hour at time later this afternoon into the early evening hours.
Let's bring another voice into this, GPB reporter Emily Jones, who's covering the storm from Savannah. Hi there, Emily.
Hey, Celeste.
So Savannah was one of our mandatory evacuation areas in Georgia. What is Savannah empty?
It's pretty empty. It's certainly emptier than it is on a regular day. But there are a fair amount of people who didn't evacuate. And actually, I should clarify that not all of Savannah. Originally, we were all under a mandatory evacuation. And then they actually walked that back as the storm kept moving further west and further west. called it, depending on which official you're talking to, it's either called a voluntary or a general evacuation for most of Savannah, but of course for the areas to the east, the areas that are in the islands and the marshes where they're really expecting to see the bad storm surge, that is still a mandatory evacuation. But a lot of people stayed behind. You know, either they rode out Matthew and they were fine, or when they saw the track shift to the west, they decided, you know, I'm not going to evacuate to somewhere in middle Georgia that's still going to see the storm. And I actually know some people who even came back, that evacuated and then decided to come back because they thought it might be better here than in Macon.
Let's actually hear from someone you spoke with, Rachel Flora, evacuated from Savannah to Moultrie. That's where her family lives. She says she's not all that used to hurricanes and other severe weather.
Nothing happens here. So I think a lot of people have that mentality that, oh, it's going to be fine. I've heard a lot of people say, oh, when this thing is over, let's go fishing, which seems like a really lackluster response to me. But since we haven't seen anything, I'm not sure how this is going to play out.
And Dave, let me bring that back to you, because Emily mentioned the storm surge. Why are we hearing about storm surges so much right now?
Well, I think the wind flow that's going into the coast right now on the east side of the storm is carrying all that water into the coastline. So I think that's the concern, is that extra like 3 to 5 feet or 4 to 6 foot water on top of, like, you know, normally dry ground is a big concern along the coast. And so I think that's even far removed from the center of the storm, the surge, the easterly wind into the coastline of Georgia, like around the Savannah area, is a big concern basically through today.
So let's hear another voice that you spoke with, Emily. This is Katie May Devine. You talked to her when she was waiting for a bus out of Savannah. She was one of the people that rode out Hurricane Matthew. She did that at her sister's house, but I guess she made a different decision this time.
It was a trauma. It was real bad. It was real bad. Trees were falling. Lights went out. It seemed like the end of the world, mostly because it was dark and big old oak trees was colliding.
Emily, do you get the sense that preparations and decisions are different in Savannah because it has not been that long since Matthew?
Absolutely. Just in terms of when people started watching this storm and making their potential evacuation plans and deciding to leave, that happened so much earlier with Irma relative to when it happened with Matthew. I mean, people were talking about this stuff as early as last weekend. You know, more at this point, more than a week ago, people have been watching this storm and saying, you know, are you evacuating? What's your plan? Here's where I'm going to go, you know, because I think there was this kind of sense for a while. You know, we heard earlier in the show from a historian talking about how long it's been since Georgia's seen a major hurricane. It had been a while since we'd seen even a hurricane of the strength of Matthew. And so there was this kind of sense that hurricanes skipped Georgia. They go right up to the Carolinas, and we don't see much impact here. And Matthew really changed that, and I think freaked a lot of people out. You know, Rachel, who we heard from earlier, another thing that she said to me was she evacuated a lot earlier. She evacuated before they even called for the mandatory evacuation for the coast, in part because of what happened with Matthew.
Dave, let me ask you about something that doesn't seem to be being discussed, which is a surprise to me, which is climate change. Is it possible that climate change can make hurricanes either more frequent or more severe?
Celeste, I don't really honestly know the answer to that. I think it's, you know, weather is so variable and dependent on so many different, you know, conditions, atmospheric conditions that, you know, and the climate, you know, changes from one day to the next and one year to the next. So, excuse me, I think it's just, we can expect, I mean, we've seen, you know, hurricanes, we've seen, you know, severe weather outbreaks, we've seen like major ice storms and winter storms, and some years, you know, you happen to get more than others, you know, and I think it just sort of balances out over time. So I really don't know the answer to that. I think, you know, it's certainly a factor that we all have to consider, but I don't necessarily have the data to support that.
Emily, how does that conversation play out in Savannah? What kind of things are people talking about when they talk about Irma?
For the most part right now, people are talking about, you know, what they expect to see, whether there's going to be damage, whether there's going to be flooding, that kind of thing. I haven't heard much discussion yet of that kind of big picture, you know, whether it's climate change, whether it's related to that broader discussion about climate change. But, you know, people are really concerned about it. And there is another sense here. You know, we already talked a little bit about Matthew and the way that it sort of was a wake-up call for people, but it's also, I mean, the impacts of Matthew are still very, very real here. There are people who either just got their houses repaired not that long ago, or I was even talking to the mayor of Tybee yesterday, and he said there are still some buildings on the island where people can't, you know, fully live in their house yet because they're still working on repairs from that storm. Officials are still talking about replenishing the dunes that got you know, really badly damaged during Matthew, which is a huge protector from flooding if the dunes are strong. So we really haven't fully bounced back yet. And so that's also been a big focus is, you know, that storm didn't just scare us, it weakened us on the coast. And now here's another one.
So, Dave, I read statistics from FEMA that said that half of all deaths in flooding are happen inside a vehicle, and that even 6 inches of water is dangerous in your car. Is there a timeline for when a storm, when the danger of a storm passes? Like when you can stop worrying?
Well, that's a great question. I think every storm is different. We obviously saw what Harvey did, and the reason Harvey became such a major disaster was the fact that it just slowed down and nearly stalled over the same area. So it was pumping in so much moisture from the Gulf of Mexico and dumping all that rain. And the thing is, it's kind of a 1-2 punch when you look at flooding, because you can get flash flooding, which is basically floodwaters that rise and cause like life-threatening conditions in a matter of hours. And then you can also have river flooding. And river flooding can happen over the course of days or even weeks in the case of like what happened with Harvey in East Texas. So even after the rains end and everything clears out, you can still have major problems along rivers and streams because there's so much water getting, you know, obviously trying to filter down into the bigger, lakes, oceans, and water.
And Irma is moving pretty slowly, is it not?
I would say no, it's moving pretty good.
Okay.
I think that last check, it was at 8 a.m., they said it was moving northwest at about 18 miles per hour, and that upper-level winds are actually driving it, you know, to the north and northwest. And so that's good news. Now, eventually it may sort of get cut off and stall out over like parts of Tennessee or whatever. But by then the system's going to be very weak and we're not going to be looking at any major, like, you know, significant rainfall like we saw with Harvey.
We're having a lot of rain up here, Emily. In the 30 seconds we have left, what is the forecast outside your window?
Tons and tons of rain. I'd be surprised if you actually can't hear it up there. It's coming down in sheets, and sometimes the wind is actually blowing the rain sideways. It is pouring, really doesn't even begin to cover how much it's raining right now.
GPB reporter Emily Jones, also National Weather Service meteorologist Dave Nadler. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the history of hurricanes in Georgia. First, though, a new generation jams in Macon, and we'll hear some very talented young musicians. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Author Greg Iles has sold millions of books. He's written 15 novels. 12 have become New York Times bestsellers. His latest is Mississippi Blood, and it's the final installment of a trilogy that he began 8 years ago. Greg Iles joined us in the spring of this year.
Thanks, Celeste. Glad to be here.
The trilogy itself features your character, Penn Cage, who was a one-time prosecutor, then a novelist, and now seems to have been for some time combining those two together. But those aren't the only novels that feature Penn Cage. How did you decide to sort of set apart these novels for a trilogy?
Well, you know, I never really intended for Penn to be a series character, but as I kept returning to themes of the South and family and race in particular, Penn proved to be a good vehicle to explore that, and particularly Penn's father, who had been who's based on my father, a beloved family physician whose practice was about 65% black patients, and he had a lot of insight into the racial situation in the South.
So why, if you didn't intend for him to be a series character, how did that happen? How did you get to your second book and say, I need to bring Penn back?
Well, I wrote the first one in 1998. And then 7 years later, I returned to a story in my hometown, Natchez, Mississippi, and Penn was the natural character to go to see the story through his eyes. And as he evolved and his family evolved as characters, I found myself returning to Natchez every 7 years or so, and as Faulkner said, exploring my own little postage stamp of America. So Penn was the natural vehicle. And so sort of against my will, I turned him into this character for the trilogy.
So I wonder if an unintended consequence is the fact that there's been more tourism in Natchez. Make people
clear. Oh, yeah. Yeah. One critic said I do Natchez the backhanded compliment of setting my novels there. I mean, I'm portraying some of the most troublesome history in 20th century America. But, yeah, tourism has certainly spiked as a result of the novels.
And I think your office, you call it Edelweiss, is located not too far from a fort where several massacres took place.
Absolutely. You know, it was built in 1883, and it was called Edelweiss then, and I restored it, and it's even featured in the book. So real life, in my books, real life intersects a lot. I mean, the civil rights murders that occur throughout the trilogy are based on real life murders that happened about 12 miles from my house in the 60s.
Okay, so we learn throughout your books, and they're heavily featured in these trilogy books, is sort of the two different examples of African-American men. One is Quentin Avery, who used to be a civil rights attorney and then became a personal injury attorney. And then there's the guy who returns from Chicago to run for mayor and then becomes a district attorney. I hope I'm not giving too much away from all your books.
No, that's good. That's a good subject, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the creation of these two characters and sort of who your inspirations are for them.
Well, I've lived in Natchez most of my life, except for leaving to go to college, et cetera. And, you know, Natchez is over 50% African-American. And like my dad, I grew up working with black guys, if I can speak colloquially, you know, and I've met a lot of different types of personalities. And here's an example of the complexity of race in a place like Natchez. Last year, I worked running communications for a black mayoral candidate who won the election with 90% of the vote in a 50% black district. Now, ironically, what we've learned is that our biggest obstacle to progress is not the white community. It's older style elements of the black community who remain obstacles to his progressive agenda. So, as you know, race is a very complex issue, not simplistic the way it's portrayed.
Do you ever have concerns? Do you get other people to read them over? We've heard talk of authors who have sort of sensitivity readers read through.
I don't do my readers are my sensitivity readers. You know, last night in the hotel, I was celebrating because the book just went number one nationwide. I got back to the hotel, and there was a letter from an African-American woman who had just finished the book, and she was a little upset. There's a strong black female character in the book, very strong.
Yeah.
But the way the book ended with her, the woman was a little upset and disappointed. But I honestly addressed my issues and the way I'd ended it, the way I had, and it satisfied her, and she said she was putting a 5-star review on Amazon. So, you know, I just go with real-time feedback. If you're an artist or you take yourself seriously, you can't go through life asking the opinions of people. You have to put your vision down.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author Greg Iles. His new novel is called Mississippi Blood. It came out last week, as you just heard. It went number one. This is the first one of your books, I think, that was number one on the USA Today list.
Yeah, I've been number one in the New York Times, but USA Today means you outsold every book of any kind in the whole country. So that's the first time I've ever done that.
All right. So you were in a fatal wreck in 2011. What I've been interested to read is some of your responses to how that changed your writing. I mean, thankfully, you're much recovered now in the ensuing 6 years, right?
Right, right. But it really comes down to this. I mean, I pulled onto Highway 61 when I was trying to write Natchez Burning as a single novel, the first book. A truck hit my door going 70, took off my leg, tore my aorta, smashed many, many of my bones, and put me in a coma. When I came out, I realized that I was, because I was writing about race, the South, family, I was not going to pull any punches, that I didn't have forever to live. And that meant being more honest than I'd ever been and maybe than a lot of people would have liked me to be.
And one of the ways that that is manifest in your books, which is always interesting to me, is the way that people talk about race in ways that you don't expect. In other words, in one of your early books, not part of this trilogy, you have the very northern Yankee girlfriend, early girlfriend of Penn Cage.
You do know these books.
Yeah. I do. I love these books. So she comes down south, and she comes down as a looking down on the South, thinking that it's the most racist place she's ever going to live. And she changes her mind completely. Are all of these things based on people that you've met and perspectives that you've heard?
Sure. I mean, I'm going to tell you what most writers want. All writers are writing about themselves, and any that tell you they're not are lying, or either lying and they don't know they're lying. Okay?
They're in denial.
One thing I hope these books have done, though, is I'm trying to break that American stereotype about the South that, oh, isn't that racism terrible down there in Mississippi, down there in Georgia? We all know racism has been bad in the South, but it's always been overt, open, out in the street. In the North, it's covert, but it's there. And if the events of the last year or two have taught us anything, it's that racism is not a sectional Southern problem. It's an American problem. And that's what I want to help address.
Now, this may be the end of the trilogy, which began with Natchez Burning, then we got Bone Tree, and now Mississippi Blood. But is this the end of Penn Cage?
Well, if you get to the end of Mississippi Blood, you'll realize there probably is room for one more.
No
it's
spoilers.
Certainly the end of the trilogy. No spoilers. But I think there'll be one more Penn book. It will not be next. But to be fair to that universe, I probably need to go back one time.
So what do you have left? What do you have left to say about Natchez? Are you done talking about your hometown?
No. Well, you know what? Natchez is emblematic of a lot of Mississippi and probably some places in Georgia. It was once one of the richest cities in the entire country, despite being so small. It's now been shrinking steadily for about 30 years. We're trying to save it, both black and white. Communities like Greenville, where Morgan Freeman has investments, communities like that have been going steadily down. We don't want to meet that fate. And I hope that my work and my books can help preserve it, because a guy said something, I'll say this about the South. A guy once said, it would be a shame that if in our rush to extinguish the South's ancient sins, we also bury its enduring virtues as well. So I want to save and preserve what's good and hopefully rectify what's bad.
So if I can just indulge my own curiosity in the last minute we have, why do you call your book tour the Nerd Tour?
Well, half of it's on land and in a vehicle, and half of it's on an airplane. And I traded in, you know, when I wrecked, I was in a very expensive all-aluminum Audi. This time we're in a brand-new Ford Flex, which very much looks like a nerdy box, so I'm calling it the Nerd Tour. You know, I play in a band with Stephen King and a bunch of writers, and we always name our tours like the Still Younger Than Keith Tour or things like that. So this is the Nerd Tour.
That was author Greg Iles. His latest novel, Mississippi Blood, hit shelves in April. Late July, we spent some time at the historic Douglas Theater, and we celebrated Macon's musical talent and paid tribute to its history, all in front of a live audience.
The Douglas Theater is a place that is history. The Douglas Theater had what they call the Saturday Morning Teenage Show, for instance. Imagine having Otis Redding, Little Richard, Ray Charles, James Brown, all competing against each other as teenagers on this talent show. Can you imagine that?
That's Johnny Hollingshed Jr., a fixture of the Macon music scene and the host of weekly jam sessions at Grant's Lounge downtown. Macon has a history of fostering talent. For 10 years now, the Otis Redding Foundation has hosted a summer camp to connect talented young people with coaches from the music industry. We talked about this with Foundation Director Carla Redding Andrews.
Most importantly, what we want to do is instill confidence in these kids.
And some of the kids from the Otis Music Camp performed for our live audience at the Douglas Theater. Here's a bit of Lee McCombs and Sarah Haseen performing their original song, The Chase. That's 15-year-old Lee McCombs and 16-year-old Sarah Haseen. We also heard 17-year-old singer-songwriter Chance Moorman. Makenite Chance Moorman with her original song, Thunderstorm. Finally, here's brother and sister duo Eris and Artist Johnston with their rendition of At Last and What a Wonderful World.
Them grow, they'll learn much more.
That was brother and sister duo Aris and Artis Johnston. Just ahead, Georgia's history with hurricanes. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Hurricane Irma is working its way through our state. Georgia and hurricanes have a long history. Our last direct hit was in 1898, but that doesn't mean we haven't seen our fair share of big storms. Senior historian with the Georgia Historical Society, Stan Deaton, recently talked about Georgia's hurricane history on his podcast, Off the Deaton Path.
What I want to talk about this week is a little history and a little weather. As you know, we have hurricanes in the Atlantic right now bearing down on the Caribbean islands and on the southeastern mainland of the United States. I am reminded that the last time we had a major hurricane, and by major we mean Category 3 or above, that made landfall in Georgia was in 1898. Now, there has been, 20th century was unusually quiet compared to the 19th. Georgia had many major storms in the 19th century, including, I think, four in the 1890s alone. So we've really gotten lucky that we have avoided this bullet for so long. I want to talk about two storms today that made history, that were catastrophic for the state of Georgia, and that is the hurricane of 1893, which was known as the Sea Islands Storm, and then the hurricane of 1898, which remains the last major storm to hit the mainland. The hurricane of 1893 hit Georgia on Sunday, August 27th. It began, as most of them do, to the east of Cape Verde on August 15th. It moved west and began turning north-northwest as it approached the Bahamas on Friday, August 25th. And that night, the winds were so powerful that Friday night was the first time that the people of Georgia on the Sea Islands could feel the approach of this storm. It tracked up the coast of Florida, stayed off the coast of Florida for over 100 miles, and then made landfall as a Category 3 hurricane near Savannah on Sunday night, August 27th, with winds of approximately 120 miles an hour, which would make it a Category 3 storm. Tremendous storm surge of about 16 feet completely submerged many of the Sea Islands. The storm moved through up through South Carolina and up the East Coast and eventually disappeared over the Maritime Provinces of Canada on September 1st. But it did a tremendous amount of damage. As you could imagine, nearly every building on the coastal Sea Islands of Georgia and South Carolina was damaged beyond repair. 30,000 people left homeless, about 2,000 people killed, many of them washed out to sea and never found. Governor Northern of Georgia did call on the Red Cross. There was no FEMA. There was no federal system for this kind of relief for a natural disaster. The states were pretty much on their own. The Red Cross finally arrived in October and delayed somewhat when another Category 3 struck just north near Charleston on October 13th. So this was a huge big deal. And in 1893 dollars, the estimated damage was about $1 million, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $25 to $30 million now. This was a hurricane that reduced Beaufort, South Carolina to rubble. Factories and warehouses along the rivers and the coast were absolutely inundated with water. And as you probably know, Georgia has 8 barrier islands on the 100 miles of coast between the Savannah River and the St. Mary's River in Florida. They do provide some measure of protection, and unfortunately, they always take the major hit when these hurricanes come ashore. But the 1898 hurricane was a little later in the season. It was formed in late September, again, east of the Lesser Antilles. It stayed on a northwest track. If you could see the track of this thing, it looked like it was headed from Georgia from the very beginning. And again, on a Sunday night, October 2nd, 1898, it made landfall on Cumberland Island down in Camden County. Record storm surge flooding. The major impact where there were people was in Brunswick. A storm surge of 16 feet hit Brunswick. There were at least 179 people killed by the storm of 1898. Damages in the millions of dollars, even by 1898 standards. And again, this storm moved ashore, weakened pretty quickly, went out over the Ohio Valley and then turned northeastward. It was last seen near Newfoundland on October 6th. So a pretty powerful storm. Almost a century later, researchers estimated the hurricane made landfall with winds of 135 miles an hour, which would put it at a Category 4 storm. But these are obviously two very, very destructive storms. And in fact, the 1898 storm covered up all of Hutchinson Island on the Savannah River. If you're familiar with Savannah, you know now the Western Hotel. If you stand on Bay Street and look across the river, you see Hutchinson Island across from you. The 1898 storm covered up 8 feet of water all over Hutchinson Island. Warehouses, storage areas all along the coast were damaged. According to the Savannah Weather Bureau, there were about 5,000 barrels of rosin and 60,000 bushels of rice that were destroyed on the docks in Savannah, which also gives you some idea of how very different our trade is now over 120 years later.
That's Stan Deaton, senior historian at the Georgia Historical Society, an excerpt from his podcast, Off the Deaton Path. It's time to add a couple more tunes to our Georgia playlist. That's our regular series where we ask people to choose two songs they think best represent the Peach State. The rules are simple. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and it can't be one of their own songs. Today's installment comes from Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Sean Mullins.
My first pick for the playlist is Midnight Train to Georgia by Gladys Knight and the Pips.
LA, rude, too much for the man.
Too much for the man. He couldn't make it.
So he's leaving the life he's come to know.
Jim Weatherly had written the song a couple years before Gladys recorded it, and he had written it as I'm leaving on a midnight plane to Houston. And it was more of a country western take on it. But she and the Pips were in the studio looking at a new record and heard this song, loved it. And being from Georgia, she wanted to change it to Midnight Train to Georgia, giving it a bit of a more Al Green R&B feel and also tagging her hometown and home state. And I thought that was amazing.
Said he's going back. To a simpler place and time. Oh, yes, he is. Love me with him. Oh, let midnight train to Georgia.
The chorus of this song is so great because she just continues to lift it and take it to the next level each time through. By the end, it's almost like you're in church. That's one of my favorite parts of the song right there, when the Pips say superstar, but he didn't get far. It's great, because it hits a little close to home. Well, because a lot of us, you know, we seek this thing. We're not really sure exactly what we're after, but sometimes once you find it, you discover it's not exactly what you want, you know. That sounds like what happens to the character in this song. Or maybe he just really couldn't cut the mustard. It's hard to know. I always thought I could cut the mustard. I just decided I didn't want to on a certain level. Like, it wasn't the way to live my life, you know.
Said he's going back to find, ooh, a simpler place and time. Ooh.
Call and answer thing with the Pips, and I love their background vocals and how they go back and forth with the, you know, the train whistle and the whole thing, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful rendition of the song. And when I think of Georgia and Atlanta and music, I think of Gladys Knight. She's one of the best. Probably, I think she should be crowned the Queen of Soul of the South.
His world than live without him in mind.
My second pick is Kid Fears by Indigo Girls. Secret staircase, running high, you had a hiding place. I've always loved this song. When the first time I heard them do it live, I remember going, wow, what a haunting melody, and very emotional, and I at the same time, I didn't know exactly what the song was about. Lyrically, it's kind of cryptic and wild, and I love that about it. Amy really writes that a lot, and I've always really admired that. It's very poetic, and sometimes she doesn't come right out and spell it out for you. You have to think about it a minute.
We know the price now, and innocent will do.
I met Amy Ray when I was 15 years old, and she was probably 19 or 20. She was at Emory at her first year there, and I was on my way to dropping out of high school. I was having a tough time. I was in a punk rock band and also just really trying to find myself as an artist and a person. Amy came to my school and talked at a career education class. It was some kind of elective I was taking to get out of something else, I'm sure. And she was in there with a Husker Du t-shirt on, you know, and ripped up blue jeans and an old Gibson guitar. And I just thought she was the coolest thing. She could tell I was a kid in trouble, I think. And she ended up writing me this really long letter. I got it a couple of weeks later. It was several pages long and really thoughtful and really caring, and just follow your dreams and you can do whatever you want to do in this life, and stuff that I hadn't heard a lot of before. So she was really an early influence for sure. I think maybe what the Georgia sound is that it's not just one sound. You know, it's not as easy to define because of where it sits in the country, and all of us that are here, everyone kind of helps to develop the sound, and it changes over time. But I think it all gets put into this wonderful stew, and we all learn and grow from it, and hopefully that's what the Georgia sound really is.
That is singer-songwriter Sean Mullins with his picks for our ever-growing Essential Georgia Playlist. If you have a song that you want to add to the list, or nominate at least, it's very easy. Tweet us at OST Talk or call and tell us, and maybe sing a little at 404-500-9457. Be brave. Sing for us. We welcome it. You can find all of our Georgia Playlist picks at gpb.org/onsecondthought. Georgia has welcomed thousands of guests fleeing Hurricane Irma. After Hurricane Katrina, our doors were also wide open. Reverend E. Leroy Brown had been preaching in New Orleans for nearly 20 years when he moved to Dallas, Georgia, and started a church in nearby Mapleton.
By me being a Christian and a man of faith, one thing I do know, nothing can happen without God knowing about it. Nothing can happen unless he permit it. Things, especially like storms and hurricanes and tornadoes and stuff, that's a part of nature. And so when these things happen, it tends sometimes to cause people to stay. But in my case, thank God, my brother-in-law was watching, who's a resident of Georgia. He was watching the situation, and he called and said, y'all better come on. My spirit told me to get your clothes and get out of here. And I did just what he said to do. So I packed up all of my good suits, all of my good shoes. I didn't take everything, but I took what I could. I told my wife to put some more stuff. She didn't do it, but a lot of stuff got messed up. I saw water, water, water. And we had about a foot of water. But what happened, that foot of water and that roof being torn off caused a lot of mildew. The whole house was full of mildew. So you couldn't live in it. everything, dead animals, dead people, dead trees, dead land, everything was just horrible. It doesn't feel like 10 years. It looked like it was a couple of years ago that it happened. One friend of mine who was a preacher, he went back to go do some work at his church, and he wasn't wearing his mask like he was supposed to. And that eventually gave him some respiratory problems, and he died. But then I knew another friend of mine who didn't heed the warning. He drowned. He and his family drowned in the attic of his house. What happened, too, before Katrina came, my wife and I were planning on retiring and moving to Georgia. We had some relatives came here in the 80s, and almost every year we would come and visit them. So we were contemplating moving here before Katrina came. So when Katrina came, we just went on and fulfilled the dream. The Spirit led me to start a church in Mableton, Georgia. And I just listened to the Spirit, and he supplied the people. Some people that I know of, they're glad to be out of New Orleans and relocate them because they're doing better. The pay scales, the employment opportunities, you didn't have so much opportunities like you have here in Georgia. When I look back at it, I see that when you don't take heed to warnings, you will suffer. But when you take heed to warnings, then you'll be a blessing to yourself.
That's Reverend E. Leroy Brown of Dallas, Georgia. He came to Georgia after Hurricane Katrina, and he spoke in 2015 to GPB producer Sean Powers. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. Has Hurricane Irma driven you out of your home? Let us know how you're doing. Call us at 404-500-9457 or post on Facebook or on Twitter. Our handle is at OST Talk. We'll continue to monitor Hurricane Irma as it passes through the state and report from several locations all across Georgia. So stay tuned to GPB or go online to gpbnews.org for updates. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Please stay safe and stay tuned.